Good morning. This is Focus 580, the second hour of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Graham, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. At the height of the civil rights struggle, few people, I expect, would have believed that the rural South would become known for progress in interracial education, while the big cities of the North would have vastly more segregated schools. But that, in fact, is the pattern that we see today. In this hour, we'll talk a little bit about what's happening with school desegregation and why. And our guest for the program is Gary Orfield. He is probably one of the country's leading experts on this subject, on education and race, particularly when it comes to this matter of who attends what schools. He's professor of education, law, political science, and urban planning at the University of California, Los Angeles. He was the co-founder and director of the Harvard Civil Rights Project and is now co-director of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. His interest for a long time has been in developing social policy with a main focus on the impact of policy on equal opportunity for success in American society. He's been with us before on this program, and we're pleased that he could once again give us some of his time today. Questions are welcome, as always. The only thing that we ask of people who are calling into the show is that they are brief in their comments, try to keep their comments brief. And we ask that so that we can get in as many different people into the conversation and keep things moving along. But of course, people who are listening are welcome to call and share their thoughts and ask questions. If you are in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, if you're listening over the air, or if you happen to be listening on the internet anywhere else in the country, you can use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455, and again, the toll-free is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you want to give us a call, you're certainly welcome. Professor Orfield, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I am fine, and how are you?
Very good.
Well, we appreciate very much you once again giving us some of your time to talk about this subject.
Well, it's good to be with you. You know, I'm an old U of I faculty member, and my kids used to go to school in Champaign Public Schools, Booker T. Washington School.
Well, we're glad to have you back with us once again. To begin, I suppose, it would be worth just having you talk a little bit about this major trend and about the important thing is that maybe we're looking at over the last 10 years, maybe a little more than 10 years, this steady growth in segregation on a national level.
Yes, what we've been seeing is a very disturbing trend since the early 1990s. This steady year-by-year increase of segregation for African-American students and for Latino students in almost all parts of the country. Some parts of the country never really desegregated, including Illinois, which has typically been one of the four most segregated states in the country for the last quarter century, primarily because of the situation in metropolitan Chicago. Other states really did desegregate quite remarkably, mostly in the South, where the desegregation efforts were concentrated and where desegregation is less difficult in some way because the school districts are bigger and the residential segregation is less extreme. For Latinos, the segregation has been growing ever since the federal data was first collected in 1968. Nothing much has been done about it. And Latinos, and by some of our measures, are the most segregated students in the country and, of course, are the least likely to finish college and have a tremendous educational deficit.
Hmm. Is this something that tends to be more of a problem in large urban areas than in rural ones?
We show that it's the large metropolitan areas that are really the epicenter of segregation now, and it's the small towns and rural areas that are the only place that's really highly integrated, and that the report that we issued is called Last to Become First, because the little towns in the South where with the Confederate monuments and where the civil rights marchers from Illinois went down to protest, are now vastly more integrated than the big metropolitan areas in the north, which have extreme levels of segregation. We find in the big central cities, there's a very substantial share of students who are going to school in schools that we call apartheid schools, 99% to 100% non-white, virtually as absolutely segregated as the South was historically before the civil rights movement.
That is something that I think is a lot of people would find a remarkable development. And in my the introduction that I did, I have to acknowledge I was freely borrowing from the introduction to this report that you point to, the one that just came out in January, the last have become first that was coming out of the Civil Rights Project there at UCLA. It does seem to be remarkable that as you write in the report, and as I said, no one would have thought, a lot of people would have thought, no, this is not going to happen. This is not the way that this is going to work out. That, in fact, that small towns and rural areas in the South would be the ones where we would say, actually, they've actually made more progress than places like, for example, Chicago on this particular issue. But that is indeed the way that things have worked out.
It's really interesting, and I think it's good for people to think about what were the structures of inequality. And down in the South, it wasn't that people were so far apart from each other physically, it was that there were laws that required them to be separate. You remove those laws, and they were removed fairly decisively by the Supreme Court and the Johnson administration, and you get a fairly decent level of integration because people are not that separate physically, residentially. But if you think about it, that system of Jim Crow, the subordination by separation by law, was the system of the South. The system of the North was residential segregation, and that was Dr. King's objective, and when he came to Chicago in the late 1960s, was to break the back of residential segregation. And he succeeded in the South. The civil rights movement succeeded in ending apartheid by law, Jim Crow, but it's really failed to break the back of residential segregation. And residential segregation for Latinos has increased substantially. It's gone down a little for blacks, but for black families with children, extremely high residential segregation remains.
And that is the big factor here in the kind of increasing segregation that you identify and that we're talking about here, again, particularly in big cities, that the bottom line is where you live is going to determine where your children go to school, and that is the big factor.
So we were... when we look at this, we find that the also very disturbing pattern of segregation is developing in the suburban areas around these big cities. Very high levels of segregation, even higher for Latinos in some ways than African Americans. And we find that over half of the Latinos in metropolitan big metros are now in the suburbs, and a very substantial share of African Americans too, but we're kind of importing that urban segregation pattern into big swaths of our suburbia. Nobody's doing much about that at all. So this is a really disturbing pattern for the future.
Well, I want to talk about something else here, and this is, again, something that you note, that when you look at the trends that we've talked about and ask this question, well, why has this happened? Something here has come into play that, again, I think in the past people would not have thought about, and that is the United States Supreme Court.
That's right.
That has taken a look at the kind of strategies that school districts have tried to put in place to deal with the impact of residential segregation on their schools, trying to develop plans, and these plans existed all over the country, aimed at trying to achieve some kind of diversity in schools by giving parents some choice as to where their children would attend, and then looking at schools and setting some kind of goals about, well, what we would like the makeup of the student body to be. Last year, there were two significant cases that were taken up by the, ended up in at the Supreme Court, two different districts, And essentially what the court said was to those districts and others who had plans like that, they said, you can't do that anymore.
Yes, we now, we've gone from a situation where in the 1950s the Supreme Court was the cutting edge of expanding the rights of minorities and bringing segregation, desegregation to places that had historically been segregated, to a court that's now the cutting edge of dismantling the desegregation and civil rights policies. And it's really in the hands of people who don't believe that anything needs to be done and that we've already done too much. So we had this extraordinary decision last June from the Supreme Court, a very divided Supreme Court, but the decision knocked down the desegregation plans in Louisville, Kentucky, and in Seattle, Washington, both of which were voluntary actions by local school boards that wanted to increase integration. And in the case of Kentucky, had produced the most integrated state in the United States for black students. That their plan has now been forbidden, and school districts have been told, you can't do anything that's intentional that directly considers the race of children in order to produce integration, which is exactly the opposite of what the Supreme Court told them in the 1960s and 1970s, that you must do that because it's the only way to dismantle a pattern of presidential segregation. So we're in a situation where you can only have desegregation, where it's accidental, where there happens to be an integrated neighborhood or people volunteer in the right numbers to produce an integrated school, or by indirection, by considering something that isn't race in the hopes that it will produce some racial diversity. So I think it's going to be remembered as one of the most peculiar and counterproductive decisions, taking away the authority of local school boards that have successfully integrated their schools to continue voluntarily to do it.
You know, I remember having read about this and talked to some people about it after the decision came down last year, that perhaps in the minds of some people there, it was not entirely clear to them what the court was saying, or at least that they were saying, it was clear that there were some strategies that the court was saying, this is unconstitutional, you can't do that, but that there seemed then, though, to be some room in there to develop a plan that might achieve the desired goal and would also pass the court's test. And now here we're now in the first school year after this this ruling. Does there, from what you know out there in schools across the country, is there still some question about whether what they're doing is acceptable or what they could do that would be acceptable?
Oh yes, there's lots of confusion because the decisions are confusing. You had four judges that really didn't want to do anything, headed by the Chief Justice and Justice Alito, who were the newest members, who were part of the Reagan administration's attack on desegregated schools when they used to work in the Justice Department in the 1980s. You've got four justices who are really very strong supporters of school integration, and in between you have Justice Kennedy, who says these particular plans aren't legal, but he thinks something could be done, and he outlines some things he thinks would be acceptable. People have trouble understanding why this was done and what it means and what their options are. What Justice Kennedy said was clearly legal is you can draw boundaries. What they clearly said was illegal was you can't assign a child solely on the basis of his race unless you're under a federal court order to deal with the aftermath of desegregation, of intentional segregation. But you can draw boundaries that would produce more integrated schools. You can choose a place to locate your schools. You can have outreach for students. And you can consider anything except race in terms of trying to produce diversity. So you can look at poverty. You can look at a student's language. You can look at the neighborhood. You can look at anything else except race. So it's making people who want to preserve diversity try to figure out what that means for their community and what would work there if they're not under a federal court order. But this is meaning that many school districts, many hundreds of school districts, magnet schools and so forth, that they're operating without a court order, are now having to scramble to see whether they can figure out a way to to continue to maintain diversity in those schools without assigning anybody or denying an assignment just on the basis of race.
I'm sure that there were a lot of other schools that were doing something very like the programs that were ruled unconstitutional by the court. Did all these districts sit down and say, well, we have to do something different? Or did some of them say, well, we're going to keep on doing what we're doing until somebody objects?
Well, I think it's all of the above. Some of them are just deciding not to try to do anything and to accept the return of segregation, which, by the way, is almost always segregation by poverty as well as race. Some of them have decided to do nothing until somebody challenges them, or some of them probably aren't aware of these decisions. And some of them are trying to figure out alternatives, like the Louisville School District, Jefferson County in Kentucky, is very actively considering and debating around its community what would be the best alternative to maintain some of the diversity that's been so successful there.
Well, as you say, I think that when the ruling came down and people like you and people in school districts were starting to ask themselves this question, well, if we cannot use race as a determining factor in where a child will go to school, we're going to have to find something else. And as you said, something like socioeconomic factors, the income level of the family, where they live, those sorts of things would be acceptable and might achieve some of the same goal as taking a look at the race of the child. I think at the same time, also, some people said, well, it's really not as good. It will get you part of the way where you want to go, but it doesn't work as well as looking at the race of the child. Is that still generally what people think, that looking at this, putting together this package of factors about the child, anything you can think of excluding race, just it's not as good?
Well, usually it does not work as well, and where it works the best is where there's tremendous differences. Well, there's two major groups in the community where it's not multiracial, where you have three or four major racial groups, and where there's huge economic and social differences or huge levels of residential segregation. If those things are present, then using an indirect measure can be reasonably successful. It's been in Raleigh, North Carolina, for example. If you have a multiracial district and there's a lot of overlap between the income distributions and so forth, and residential segregation isn't extremely intense, nothing works very well compared to an actual race-oriented remedy. What you're basically trying to do is to achieve something in which you're not allowed to consider directly the goal, in the sense that you're trying... People want to have racial integration in communities where it's been successful, but actually doing it directly is prohibited, so that you're trying to deal indirectly. Now, there's educational reasons to say social and economic desegregation is really valuable independently of how much it does for racial desegregation, because isolated high-poverty schools, even if they're white schools, tend to perform very poorly.
Hmm. Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Gary Orfield. He is professor of education, law, political science, and urban planning at the University of California, Los Angeles. He was co-founder and director of the Harvard Civil Rights Project for a number of years and is now the co-director of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. And he has been interested in a long time in social policy, particularly having to do with what you can do with policy to address the issue of opportunity or equal opportunity for success in American society. And certainly he is quite well known for doing research on and talking about public education and issues of integration and segregation. Questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to go on and give you the opportunity to talk about this area here that you've now just touched on, and that is why integration matters, why it matters to schools, why it matters to students, and that the fact is that you actually can draw a connection between the diversity of the student body and student performance.
Well, there's a number of dimensions that are important. One of the things I should say at the beginning is no one who's involved in this business thinks that school integration is a panacea or it is enough to create equality in American society. Mm-hmm. Obviously, inequality is rooted in income, it's rooted in housing, it's rooted in job opportunities. There's many dimensions of inequality. School integration is one of the things that needs to be done, and it needs to be done in part because school segregation is a multidimensional inequality that perpetuates inequality between the generations. Not because there's anything wrong with black kids or Hispanic kids, but because segregated non-white schools almost always have concentrated poverty, which means that they have kids who are there for less time because poor families move more often, more kids that are less healthy because we don't have good health care for poor people in the society. They have kids whose parents have lower levels of education and less power in the community. They tend to have less experienced and less highly qualified teachers. They tend to have lower levels of competition from the peer group. They tend to have weaker connections to college. They tend to have much higher dropout rates from high school. There's multiple inequalities that affect those schools. Now, sometimes there's a wonderful leader in one of those schools and a team of people who overcome all those things, but it's rare and very uncommon, and it's not fair because it's a tremendously difficult job. What segregated schools can't do in any circumstance is prepare people for an integrated society. And the society that we have in the United States now among young people is 43% non-white and changing about a little over 0.5% each year. So young people are going to grow up in a society where most of the people are going to be non-white. Here in California, it's over two-thirds non-white students statewide in terms of the school enrollment. Whites are the most isolated population in this situation, especially suburban whites. And their children, like everybody's children, is going to need to know how to function successfully in a multiracial setting. And you can't really learn how to do that living in a segregated neighborhood and going to a segregated school. You can't learn how to do it well. So there's what we see in segregated schools is they prepare you for a segregated society. Schools tend to have self-perpetuating effects. Integrated schools, desegregated schools, tend to prepare you for an interracial society, an interracial life that actually works more successfully. We know that kids who go to integrated schools, if they are from high-poverty minority communities, are more likely to graduate and they're more likely to go to college. They're more likely to live and work in desegregated settings as adults. These are all important outcomes that are difficult to achieve, accepting a system of segregation. For immigrant kids, the segregation is often triple segregation by ethnicity, poverty, and by language, which really is disabling in terms of probable educational success. And it's one of the reasons for the tremendously high dropout rate and very low college completion of particularly Latino kids in the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a caller here to talk with, someone in Champaign. Let's do that. They're on our line number one. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Professor Orfield, I'm a follower of yours and have read a good many of your books and articles over the years, and I'm very happy that you're on the program today. The question I have for you is one that I've encountered many times in conversations with people about this topic, and let me just put it succinctly. I think you may have addressed this somewhat. Many African-American apologists for education say that all black schools can perform just fine if the school board just funds them and supports them with the appropriate amount of resources, and the same argument is made for all girls' schools. How do you address the seemingly increasing movement towards more homogeneous gender-related and race-related schools by those that supposedly diversity is supposed to help? And I'll hang up and listen. Yeah.
Well, I really haven't done studies of the separate gender schools. One of the ways I stay out of total trouble is not expressing opinions on things that I haven't studied. In terms of all black schools being successful if they get more money and so forth, I have to say there are schools that are all black that are successful in some important dimensions and that achieve good acquisition, particularly of basic skills, and do better, and graduation rates and so forth, that tend to be run by very dedicated people who work very, very hard. And wherever there's a school like that, I say, it should be admired and supported, and that person shouldn't be promoted to be an assistant superintendent. They should be given a reward to stay there and do it. The basic problem is that's very rare. It's very rare. In Chicago, when I used to be at the University of Chicago, we looked at 1,600 schools in the metropolitan area. We found a handful of schools that had that kind of record. And those schools tend to be somewhat unstable. If a principal leaves, they tend to collapse. So, yes, it can be done. And where it's done, it should be praised. It can't prepare a student for an integrated life, though. For example, we studied some of the major law schools in the country before the Supreme Court affirmative action case, and we found virtually no minority students were in those elite law schools unless they'd had a lot of integrated experience in their lives. The only people who got there from segregated experiences were whites. So what I say about this is, there are situations where people overcome the double or triple segregation that students achieve, and that should be admired, but that it isn't a workable model on any large scale, because it's never worked on a large scale. And there have been many places where there have been transfers to minority control of schools and so forth that haven't worked at all that way. We did a book on Atlanta in a decade in which Atlanta had more money than any of its suburban school districts for 10 years, and we found essentially no relationship between the amount of money and achievement, but a very strong relationship between the poverty levels of the schools, which were very related to race, and the achievement levels. So just putting money in certainly isn't enough. And typically, students who get out of those highly concentrated schools have better chances in life. And if we do desegregation the right way, which is to really change the school internally, and we get really substantial gains for disadvantaged students.
Well, again, for people who are listening, you're welcome to call with questions, with comments. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. I find myself again going back to your discussion about the Supreme Court and its rulings about the strategies that districts have used to try to address the issue of segregation and to create schools with diverse student makeup. The way that they were, what they were trying to do, where they were placing heavy consideration on the race of the child, where they were setting targets for the makeup of the school and using that as a factor in determining where a child would go, the court says, well, you can't do that anymore. There are other things that they could do, but as you say, I think that people in the educational policy field and people who are superintendents and teachers and so forth feel that that's not as good. It will help get you where you want to go, but it's not as good. Having said all that, though, it seems that given the position at the Supreme Court, there doesn't really seem to be much of anywhere for districts to go. There are certain things that they know that they can do and certain things that they know that they can't, and there doesn't really seem to be any way to get around that, is there?
Well, if a district's under a court order, I strongly recommend they stay under it, since they Once they get out from under court order, ironically, they lose all their freedom of local control to address desegregation directly. Hmm. That's the irony of this decision. Things that you must do or can do easily under court order, you're forbidden to do as soon as you don't have a court order, which really discourages voluntary action and makes it more complicated. If you want to maintain diversity and you're not under court order now, you have to do some serious analysis. And one of the things we're going to say in a report that we're, or a manual that we're issuing with the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund tomorrow, is that we should take advantage of the necessity to reanalyze what we're doing in areas to think about some possible gains, like creating dual immersion language magnet schools, for example, where kids would learn from each other and become fluent in both languages. It's very clearly legal under this decision to consider a child's language background, for example, as a desegregation standard. No prohibition at all, and there's ways to do that produce major educational possibilities. So one of the things that you do when you get lemons is see if there's any lemonade out there, and there is in some ways as you think about looking at old plans and thinking about ways that you might create new educational options as part of a new plan.
All right. Let's talk with another caller. This is someone listening this morning in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a quick comment. I've only been listening intermittently, but I grew up pretty much as a minority through most of my education, and I thought it was a really good thing. I think the tenor, the tone of the immigration debate would change a lot if, you know, people actually lived with you know, illegal immigrants and view them as people. But when I was a little kid, living with my grandmother in a more of an upper middle class neighborhood, the only contact I had with like minority students was kids from really, really poor neighborhoods. And that was pretty much my only contact. So as a first grader, I kind of thought that all black kids and all Mexicans were dirty, smelly, and stupid. And, I consider there to be caveats with trying to integrate schools. You know, if you take, a bunch of poor kids to an upper middle class school, I mean, it could work, but sometimes you get the kind of experience that I had.
I think that's a very important observation. You know, how you do this matters tremendously, and it's most difficult when race and class seem to be so highly correlated that people assume that things that are the product of poverty are the products of race and so forth. How you do this in the school matters a lot. And the other report that we released, and by the way, you can see these on the website of civilrightsproject.ucla.edu, was a national survey of teachers. And what we found in that survey of teachers across the country was that the teachers in the white areas, like the one that you lived in, have the least preparation and are least ready to adapt. What's important about integration, if you're going to go from desegregation, from bringing kids in the same building, to successful integration, and this is true of colleges and other institutions as well as schools, how you do it matters a lot. There's research that for the last 50 years really shows the conditions of integration matter tremendously, and the conditions that produce positive outcomes are leadership that's really committed, that creates a vision of a successfully integrated institution, equal treatment of students. Transformation of institutions from being a white institution where there's some outsiders in it to an institution that's really interracial in staffing and in attitude and in content. And those are the really big gains that can come when you do this kind of thing right. And in order to do that, you have to offer teachers training and support, and you have to have curriculum that reflects and respects the different kids and teaches a message to all the kids. It's very different from just letting a stereotype get reinforced.
So you just to pick up on one of the points you made, you would say that that diversity in the faculty is as important as diversity in the student body.
I think it's very important. I think it's important that the institution not be seen as a white institution with some outsiders in it, or a black or Latino institution with some outsiders, but an institution where the adults and the children are integrated and that they show mutual respect and they learn from each other. Teachers need to learn about these things too. Many of our teachers are from segregated backgrounds and aren't comfortable dealing with issues of race. We found that the vast majority of teachers of all races want to say, if they just treat everybody the same, it'll all work out. Of course, if you treat everybody the same and you don't understand how it's going to be interpreted from different cultures, or you don't understand why kids are behaving the way they are, or how to deal with their parents, it doesn't work out very well.
One of the things I find myself thinking is, once again, just what a difficult position the schools are in, that we have had this tendency for a long time to identify particular problems and then somehow try to engineer the public school system as a way of dealing with those problems. And I wonder whether we're putting burdens on schools that it's more than they can possibly bear, or handing them problems that are more than they can possibly address.
Well, I think it's foolish to think that the schools by themselves are going to solve all these problems. You know, a lot of these inequalities and stereotypes are rooted in separation of employment, of a differential parent education, of all kinds of other problems that need to be addressed. With the immigrant populations, we need to think not only about educating the kids, but educating the parents, because many of them are coming really wanting to work, very ambitious, very committed to their families, but unable to, without the human capital, to get a decent job. And that results in tremendously negative effects on their children's education. Just thinking about what the school can do and just thinking about educating the child isn't really enough. So I agree with you. This is more than should just be put on schools. But the problem is we aren't addressing it in the other institutions, and we need to. We need to be thinking about housing. We need to be thinking about employment. We need to be thinking about political participation, welcoming people into all of our institutions. So you're right, but the truth is the schools are the only semi-universal institution that we have that's actually working on this. They've got about 90% of the kids in the country, and they have been working on this at least intermittently for quite a long time. And what they do does make a big difference.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Gary Orfield. He's professor of education, law, political science, and urban planning at the University of California, Los Angeles. He was the co-founder and director of the Harvard Civil Rights Project and is now the co-director of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. They have been doing research on the subject for a long time and have put out a number of reports. And I just wanted to mention the most recent, titled The Last Have Become First, Rural and Small Town America Lead the Way on Desegregation, which takes a look at the problem of segregation and increasing segregation that we have seen in a lot of schools in the United States, particularly in schools that are in major metropolitan areas, something that's really been happening, an identifiable trend that's been going on now since the 1990s, the early 90s. This is a report that has just come out in January of 2008. And if you're interested, I think, can people read this report on the Civil Rights Project website?
Absolutely. All of our reports are available and can be copied and used in classes with no charge.
All right, very good. So if you're interested in reading a report, you can take a look at it. And questions are welcome to 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana, here where we are. We also do have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us around the state of Illinois, Indiana, wherever the signal will travel. And, of course, if you're listening on the Internet around the country, you may also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And we have another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, sir. I'm just coming in on the conversation, but I've read some of your work, and I know your Civil Rights Project I was good at Harvard, and I guess it's equally as good at UCLA. When I was listening to it, I was thinking that maybe this integration versus segregation is a moral issue, and that the difficulty we experience is that you can't compel successfully people to go to school with people of different races, classes and ethnic origins unless they want to do it from the heart. And I think that may be a problem we have. Our hearts just aren't committed to it. And then I begin to think that institution in our society that should be able to change the heart to a impartial status would be our churches and religious institutions. And then I thought that may not work because the most segregated hour in this country is 11 o'clock on Sunday. But I still subscribe to the notion that the ministers and the churches would adopt this policy that we're all the same, irrespective of outward differences, then maybe this integration of our schools could really become a reality. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I have a variety of ways of thinking about this. You know, this was one of the great debates about the South. Should we wait? The Southern moderates said we should wait until we change the hearts and minds and not try to force change on the South. That never happened, though, and change was forced on the South in the 1960s. And the interesting thing is racial attitudes in the South became much better after the change was forced. And I think that's because the racial fears and hostility and polarization were based on false stereotypes about what was going to happen if we ever crossed the racial lines. And when people actually crossed them, they found none of those things happened, and they found people basically wanted the same thing from all racial groups, and they found commonalities that they didn't know about. And I think part of the reason why those attitudes changed is people were acting in a way that was inconsistent with what their faith says. We did a conference at Harvard with the Harvard Divinity School, produced a book called Religion, Race, and Justice in a Changing America. And it's very clear that all of the major religious traditions that are present in the United States believe that everyone is fundamentally equal before God. And that, you know, I think one of the reasons why Dr. King was so successful and one of the reasons why the experience of integration is actually much more positive than people fear before it happens is because people have in their minds two inconsistent things. One is a fear of strangers, and the other is a belief that we're all fundamentally equal some way. And when they find they can actually live that belief, a lot of people feel very positively about it. And I think that that framework was key to what happened in the revolution in the South. So I believe that that change comes more from decisions to produce a new reality that people then adjust to than it comes from just people's hearts changing. But I do believe that one of the reasons that change can work is that people do have values that can be activated in the new setting that are positive about successful crossing of racial barriers.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Again, we have a couple of minutes left in this hour, and if someone would like to call in very quickly here, we'd be sure to get them in before we end up out of time. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We are in a presidential election season, and candidates will be talking about all of the things that they think are particularly important. I'm just wondering whether you have heard many candidates talking about education, talking about the fact that the schools that American students go to are not equal, and that there can be a tremendous difference between the schools that children attend and the quality of education that they receive at those schools. Do you hear anybody talking about this?
You know, John Edwards talked about this quite a lot, but he's not running anymore. I have not heard very specific discussions of this issue. Now, there is a lot of discussion about No Child Left Behind, which we've also done a study of in six states, including Illinois. And I think that No Child Left Behind is going to be changed as a result of this election, probably whoever wins. We're going to go from a very simplistic punitive model to something that makes a little more sense. But none of the leading candidates now have chosen to take up the issue of integration as a major goal. Now, Barack Obama has, of course, talked about crossing the lines quite a lot, but without any specifics. I think that the talk about the Supreme Court is very present in this campaign, and
on the Republican side, everybody's promising to appoint more justices, like the justices that are rolling back civil rights policy on the court now, which would, of course, have a consequence for these kinds of issues. But they're not being directly and centrally discussed.
Mm-hmm. Just since you mentioned No Child Left Behind and a lot of the controversy about it, and the particularly the fact, I think some people would say that it's all sticks and no carrots, that what it's done is that it's said to schools, well, the big buzzword is accountability, and it said to schools, we're going to expect you to set standards, and we're going to expect then students to meet those standards, and that's going to determine what sort of money you're going to get from the federal government. You meet the standards, you don't get the money. And I think the criticism of a lot of people is that, well, then what we're doing is we're preparing students to take the test to meet the standards, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're getting the kind of education that we would like. You think that no matter who the next president is, that this is going to change, or does that depend on having a change?
I think it's going to change whoever's the next president, because I believe the Republicans also are hearing a lot of negatives about No Child Left Behind. It's basically a policy that assumes that without providing the resources, if you coerce schools strongly enough so they can achieve results that have never been achieved on large scale, so far as I can tell, anywhere in the world, getting all the children above average by a certain deadline and making progress for every subgroup in a predictable way every single year without changing anything about the rest of their lives and without giving schools any substantial new resources, it's really an absurd policy, and it kind of results in people beating up on schools and and produces superficial reform that are aimed at test score results rather than fundamental educational reform, which is difficult and which takes resources. So I think that we'll get somewhat better policy who's ever elected, and it'll be a major, I would think, a major rewrite if we get a Democratic administration.
Mm-hmm. So this was, it's not just a case of a fine goal, bad execution. You would say the problem was not, it was both. It was maybe not, the goal was not right to in the first place, and so no matter what the execution was, the basic idea was flawed from the start.
The basic idea is flawed. And I often use an analogy that from the days that I used to be at the University of Illinois, when, you know, about the cornfield that they have that's been observed every day for the last 130 years or whatever, in the middle of the university campus. They've observed it and measured it, and that's important, and that's part of No Child Left Behind. But when the corn doesn't grow, they didn't hit it. they tried to figure out how to cultivate it and how to fertilize it and so forth. And that's what we need to do. We need to keep the measurements from No Child Left Behind and the idea that we make progress, but then we have to figure out how to cultivate, how to repair the schools and how to nourish them, so that they can deal with more of these challenges. And in my view, one part of that is to create less extremely segregated schools and to create real incentives for teachers to be in these schools instead of punishing them if they're in a school that's really dealing with disadvantaged kids, even when they're making a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a counterproductive and simplistic model, and that we need to change it substantially.
Well, we're coming to the point here. We have a minute or so left. This is a subject that we have discussed, that is, you and I have discussed now a couple of times, and we had some other people on the program to talk about it, particularly after the Supreme Court decision of last year. And you pointed out right at the very beginning of the program that this trend that we have talked about, that is of increasing segregation, particularly in big metropolitan areas of the country, something that you've been tracking now going back back to the early 90s, if we had the same conversation a year from now, do you think that essentially we're going to end up having the same conversation? I'm wondering, as you think about here now, at least into the next couple of years, whether you think that this trend is going to continue, or there's some possibility that things might really change.
Well, I think that we are in a path towards even more extreme segregation as a result of the Supreme Court decision, which will result in less desegregated options in many school districts around the country. I think if we're going to have any substantial change in the longer term, we need different housing policies and different education policies and some support for actually addressing this issue. We used to have a program that was the Federal Desegregation Assistance Program that produced a lot of magnet schools and other efforts around the country, which were quite successful and provided money for training teachers to deal with interracial schools and so forth. That was canceled by the Reagan administration. It was a big mistake, I think. If we're going to address the racial transformation of the United States, we are in the last generation of white majority. We have to have a plan to address it, and we have to have some resources to address it. It's not something people know naturally how to address, and we have to have some leadership that gives us a different vision of where we're going. So part of the answer to that is will depend on what the election is and how that begins to transform things. Eventually, Supreme Court appointments, congressional action, administrative action, and so forth could turn us in a more positive direction, but we're headed in a really bad direction right now on these issues.
Well, there, for this moment, we'll have to leave it with our thanks to Gary Orfield. He's professor of education, law, political science, and urban planning at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's the co-director of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. They have issued a number of reports and studies looking at the issue of segregation, desegregation in public schools. The most recent is The Last Have Become First, looking at rural and small-town America, leading the way on desegregation. That was just released in January. This and others are available for you to read on the website of the Civil Rights Project, so you can go and take a look at those reports there. And Professor Orfield, thank you very much.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, and I just wanted to say one last word, which is we and a number of other educational organizations around the country really are happy to help school districts that are trying to cope with this Supreme Court decision. Pleasure to be with you.
All right. Thank you again.